There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, Annabelle Corton, and the rest of the team, only on DubaiEye 103.8.
Hello, good morning, and welcome to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corton, and with me in the studio is my co-host, David McAdam. Hi, how are you?
Good morning, Annabelle. Good morning to everyone in the studio. Great to be here, and thank you for having me.
More importantly, who are you?
Well, good question. Some mornings I wonder, but I am the CEO of the Middle East Council of Shopping Centers. And I've been fortunate enough to write a book called Retail Evolution in the Gulf, Souks to Malls. And then I've also been able to publish a magazine that we've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years called The Retail People Magazine. And sometimes when I'm lucky, I get invited to go back to the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature to be a host on that show. So that's who I am.
Welcome to the studio, David.
Great to be here.
And if you're currently wondering, who is this Annabelle and why is she on my radio? I work for the Emirates Literature Foundation during the week, and I pop in here on Saturday because I read a lot and have nothing better to do. And if I didn't have somewhere to talk about it all, I'd probably start a blog that no one would read. So that's why I'm here. Now on with the show. So today, on Talking of Books, we will be throwing a belated birthday party for Roald Dahl with a real-life Oompa Loompa in the studio. I am not joking. Finding out who Rumi was and what a woolly mammoth and Facebook have in common. And in addition to all that, we also strand an author on a desert island because we can, because we're really mean, but it's fun. And now, it's Roald Dahl's belated birthday party. Woo!
Yeah, whoa.
I don't have any of those really annoying, what are they called, the like little trumpet things that people use at birthday parties?
Blower.
The noisemakers.
Noisemakers. There we go.
Mini vuvuzela.
But so welcome to the studio, Rachel Hamilton. We have Alex in the studio as well, and Jodie Hamilton too. Before we move on with our Roald Dahl birthday party, I have an interesting anecdote to share that will help with all your dinner party conversation later. And that is, so Roald Dahl's birthday party was the 13th of September this week. And picture this. So this is some fan mail that was sent back in 1989 by a 7-year-old. And it's probably some of the best fan mail that I've ever seen. So this 7-year-old, she's called Amy, and she decides to send something to Roald Dahl. But she doesn't just send your average fan letter, okay? She took inspiration from her favorite book, which was the BFG. And she sent Roald Dahl a bottle of oil, colored water, and glitter. And that being A Bottled Dream, which is an important part of the book, the BFG. And Roald Dahl had seen fan mail before. He'd been sent lots and lots of fan mail, but this was some of the best that he'd ever seen, and he thought it was so good that he wrote her a letter, and this is the letter that he wrote back to 7-year-old Amy. He said, "Dear Amy, I must write a special letter and thank you for the dream in the bottle. You are the first person in the world who has sent me one of these, and it intrigued me very much. I also liked the dream. Tonight I shall go down to the village and blow it through the bedroom window of some sleeping child and see if it works. With love, Roald Dahl." So what's amazing is that's something that he actually did with his own children, and he pretended to be the BFG, and he would go into their bedrooms and he would create the magic of the BFG and make them think that he was blowing dreams into their bedroom window before that they went to sleep. So he's quite a magical author. But who was Roald Dahl? Who can actually tell us who Roald Dahl was for anybody who is living in a cave and doesn't know who he is? I'm putting you on the spot, Rachel.
Oh, are we all allowed to join in? I wasn't sure if we were taking turns.
You're allowed to join in now.
Roald Dahl was a fantastic author, born in 1916, still covering all the shelves in all the bookshops today, so he hasn't done too badly. Interestingly, one of my favourite facts about Roald Dahl is he wasn't always known for being brilliant at writing English. So when he was at school, and speaking to friends, I think the most interesting school reports are the ones where you didn't necessarily do that well. So while you're at school, you're desperate to get all the A stars and the top marks and to get these lovely things written about you. But when you're getting on a bit like I am, the school reports that are fun are the ones where there's something a bit quirky. And so apparently an English teacher once wrote on Roald Dahl's school report, "I have never met anybody who so persistently writes words meaning the exact opposite of what is intended." And it was obviously meant as an insult, but it's completely true. And it's while he's so fantastically famous, recognised, appreciated today. So yay, Roald Dahl.
Yay, Roald Dahl, absolutely.
And happy birthday.
And happy birthday a couple of days ago.
Yeah, belated birthday, yeah. Any excuse for a party or talking books, really. So you have all got rather interesting Roald Dahl names. So for Roald Dahl Day, the Roald Dahl Day Foundation or Estate or Roald Dahl's Estate put together this amazing thing called a party pack. And in it, they have lots of incredible exercises and activities to do if you are a child or a child who hasn't grown up like myself. And one of the things that you can do is you can figure out what your Roald Dahl character name would be. So my name is no longer Annabelle for the rest of the show. It is the Frightsome Boggis.
Excellent.
Okay. Would you like to know what yours is, Rachel?
Very much so. I bet it's dreadful. I always get a really, really rubbish
is.
One on things
it really
like
is.
This.
Yours is the Snitching Trunchbull.
Oh.
Alex, you are the Frightsome Blabbersnitch.
Yay.
Jodie, you're the Rotsome Trunchbull.
Oh yeah, we're both Trunchbull.
And I'm saving the best for last because David, you're the Whoopsie Splunkers Hornswoggler.
You'll have to repeat that slowly so I can write it down and I know I can identify myself.
The Whoopsie Splunkers Hornswoggler.
Thank you.
Okay, now, Alex, we are going to talk about all the Roald Dahl books that are our favourites, our favourite moments from them. You've brought in my personal favourite today, which is George's Marvellous Medicine. Can you tell us a little bit about George's Marvellous Medicine and more importantly, why you love it so much?
I love George's Marvellous Medicine because George is such a curious character. He wonders what will happen and he's not afraid to put it all in. I personally would be too afraid to put like all the pills in or all the painting because you could really kill someone with that.
Yeah, he puts in some really awful stuff. Every single variation is worth it. I mean, he puts in toothpaste, he puts in paint. What else does he put in?
He puts in like
glue.
He puts in the flea powder for dogs, which is my personal favourite ingredient.
Oh, I think we need to watch out all the seats in the studio.
Because if the dogs eat the flea powder, the dogs will explode, which I find really funny. Even though I have a dog, so I don't want him to explode.
And do you remember, how long ago did you read George's Marvellous Medicine?
2 days ago.
2 days ago?
Well...
So is it a recent favourite?
No, I read it like a really long time ago, but I went over it in an hour just 2 days ago.
But why do you like George's Marvellous Medicine compared to, say, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or the BFG?
Because I prefer it because, like, the way that Mr. Killiecrankie and all of the other characters are, like, for me it just, like, I feel like they're, like, so real. But George's Marvellous Medicine, I don't get that same feeling as George's Marvellous Medicine. Wait, did I just say George's Marvellous Medicine twice?
Yeah, you did. But it's Roald Dahl Celebration Day, so we can say what we want and we can kind of make stuff up, so it really doesn't matter.
Okay.
So I have asked a few people in my life to come up with a marvellous medicine of their own. And the one who came out on top was actually my mum. And she started off making a sort of smoothie. And then I said, no, it really has to be nasty. It can't be nice. And she felt like she was being really mean. So she added crickets, liver, marmite, prunes, squid ink, spinach, pine needles, ambergris, nettles and glitter.
That would do it for me.
That would do it, wouldn't it? So, Rachel, what's your favourite?
My favourite book?
Yeah.
It's The Witches, and it always has been. I like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is why I am today an Oompa Loompa, because somebody told me, come dressed up, everybody will come dressed up. and I feel a bit like Bridget Jones.
To be fair, I can't put my top hat on with the headphones. That's the only reason.
But yeah, so I do like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but Witches has been my favourite. And I think it's partly because of how I was introduced to it. So I was 10 when the book came out, and we were read it at school. And Roald Dahl is so clever about thinking of the location where it'll be seen. And so there's a line in it where he says... And the teacher was reading the book, and it talks about witches, and he says, she might even be your lovely school teacher who's reading these words to you at this very moment. And I just thought, brilliant. Force these teachers to embarrass themselves, get all the kids laughing at. I mean, nicely, but just such a good touch. And so it's witches for me, and I love this idea of witches who, even though they look like ordinary women in ordinary clothes, living ordinary lives, underneath they have these long talons and these bald heads, and they're out to get you. Fantastic.
I think he had a real problem with authority. I think that's the running theme throughout his books.
A little bit, yes.
More on this and some fun facts about Roald Dahl when we come back.
Young reviewer, young minds, big ideas. From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Good morning and welcome back to Talking of Books with Annabelle Corton and David McAdam and a host of others in the studio. And this morning we're talking about Roald Dahl. But before we get into that, does anybody really know what Roald Dahl did before he became an author?
I think I do. We've got a lot of raised hands in the studio.
Rachel, why don't you start? Oh, Alex. Okay, Alex, you go ahead.
He was a fighter pilot in World War II.
An ace fighter pilot, yes.
Yes, he was. And he also, for a while, he was a spy.
Yes, he was. And he was a chocolate historian as well, which I think is pretty amazing given his history with chocolate books. And a medical inventor, but I'm not sure what he invented medically.
He invented something. His son was ill. His son had an accident. And so Roald Dahl, together with, I think, a hydraulic engineer and someone at Great Ormond Street, invented some valve that would help them, and it was used on almost 3,000 children, apparently.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing.
Is there anything that he didn't do?
He was a Renaissance man. Not in the Renaissance.
So he was also the author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, the BFG, and some other original, evergreen, and beloved children's books. And he is, for many, the world's number one storyteller still to this day. And it's not surprising to see why. I mean, he was prolific. So we're celebrating his birthday today, a little belatedly, granted. But what I'd like to do is talk about a very famous mouse incident. Would you like to give us a little bit of context to the mouse incident, Rachel?
Well, Roald Dahl used to go to a school called Repton, which they have a Repton here, so there's a connection with Dubai, sort of. And when he was 8 years old, he and four of his friends hated the local sweet shop owner, and they went down there, and to annoy her they called her mean and loathsome Mrs. Pratchett, and they dropped a dead mouse in a jar of gobstoppers, and they got in so much trouble at the time. They were caned, all the punishments the school could throw at them. But what happened afterwards, when you know, you get the blue plaque put up when you're famous on the house you were born in or wherever, his blue plaque was put up at that sweet shop. So even though at the time it was the worst thing that could have happened, later in the years it was a claim to fame for the sweet shop.
And I think that probably influenced a lot of his work.
I suspect he was already.
So here we have a stinky dead mouse and what makes a good children's author, according to Roald Dahl.
My four friends and I had come across a loose floorboard at the back of the classroom. One day, we lifted up and found a dead mouse. It was an exciting discovery. Hold on a tick, I said. Why don't we slip it into one of Mrs. Pratchett's jars of sweets? Then, when she puts a dirty hand in to grab a handful, she'll grab a stinky dead mouse instead.
When you're old enough and experienced enough to be a competent writer, by then you'll become pompous and adult, grown up, and you've lost all your jokiness. You don't have any, and so, unless you are a kind of undeveloped adult, and you still have an enormous amount of childishness in you, and you giggle at funny stories and jokes and things, I don't think you can do it.
The five of us left school and headed for the sweet shop. We were tremendously jazzed up. We felt like a gang of desperados setting out to rob a train. We were the victors now, and Mrs. Pratchett was the victim.
I love that jazzed up.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Do you feel that you are very much like Roald Dahl in that you haven't lost all of your silliness?
I wish I could write as well as Roald Dahl, but I do feel that there is a sense of underdeveloped adult or whatever he says about me.
I think so too. I mean, you have dressed as an Oompa Loompa today and there is a green wig next to you. So,
hooray.
Yeah.
No, but I think that's true of all children's authors. If you come to the Lit Fest and you see the children's authors, they're a slightly different bunch from everyone else. And I
eccentric.
Think we always have slightly more fun because we laugh at stupid things.
One of the things that I love about Roald Dahl, if we're on the topic of his life and fun facts and things like that, and that's Willy Wonka and the, or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory rather. But Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory was inspired by Cadbury and Roundtree's at the time. And during his childhood, they were the two largest chocolate manufacturers in England. And they were often engaged in corporate espionage. And I sometimes amuse myself by imagining what that must have been like, fighting and corporate espionage over chocolate recipes. And this led to extreme secrecy in the development and manufacturing processes. And it was this secrecy that inspired him to write Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And he's actually talking about it here, about testing chocolate as a child, which seems like the best job that you can have as a child, testing chocolate. And the research room where they would have new ideas for chocolate and how that inspired him.
At school, every boy in our house used to be given each term a plain brown cardboard box with 12 chocolate bars in it. And each of these, except for the one, which was a control bar and was always a coffee cream bar, they were new inventions from a famous chocolate manufacturer. And we were meant to taste them. We were given them free and we tasted them and there was a bit of paper in there and we marked them all from 0 to 10. I realised then, you see, that this vast chocolate factory had in it a room, a secret room, where fully grown men and women spent their entire time trying to think up and invent new chocolate bars for children. And I've never been in one or seen one or met anyone who's worked in one, but they clearly must exist, mustn't they?
So going with the idea that they clearly must exist, Jodie, if you were to pitch a product to Mr. Wonka, a brand new chocolate or new sweet idea, what would it be? And you have to wow me because I am Mr. Wonka's apprentice today.
So I've created this product, which is when you buy like a pack of plain cookies. And then on the side, you pick like a choice of 10 of your favourite toppings. And whenever you feel like having a cookie, whatever you like crave for the topping, you put inside this like machine and then you press the topping that you want and then there's your cookie.
Do they make you levitate?
No.
Aww. Do they make you invisible?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
I decided
cool.
this beforehand. Definitely I did. I didn't do this on the spot at all, she says. So what's your favourite Roald Dahl book?
Matilda.
Why is Matilda your favourite?
It's just so... it's so interesting because it's the parents are saying that she shouldn't be reading books, whereas normally it's the parents saying you should. So it was like it was quite interesting to read about how she was put down in her house because she read so much. So yeah, I love the book.
Have you read Matilda, Alex?
Yeah, I have.
What do you think to Miss Trunchbull?
But I think she's like the most terrible head teacher ever, and I really would hate to have a head teacher like that.
Well, she does do some awful stuff.
Yeah, like swinging the girl over the fence.
I think it's kind of unfortunate that your last name today is Trunchbull, but oh well. So when did you read Matilda, Jodie? When was the first time? Do you remember that?
When I was about 7, I want to say, because it was one of the first books I read, because Roald Dahl was the first author that I really enjoyed. So my first book I remember reading was BFG when I was in year 1, and then I think Matilda was after that.
Yeah. I think the one I remember reading was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and the BFG, and George's Marvelous Medicine was my absolute favourite. So I'm with Alex on this one. I think it's because I like lists, though. That's the only real reason. So I have the moment that Rachel has been absolutely dreading. And it's time, Rachel, for your quiz.
I've already told the kids they're allowed to help me cheat. Roald Dahl will be completely up with cheating. So if I don't know the answers, jump in.
Okay, you've got three questions.
Okay.
All right, so first question. What's the name of the awful headmistress in Matilda?
Yay, Mrs. Trunchbull.
Miss Trunchbull.
Miss Trunchbull. Oh, I still get the point. Give me the point.
Half a point. I'm going to be really strict with you. Who played the BFG in the 2016 film adaptation? Oh no, you don't know this one.
I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to skip it. We'll come back to it. And what is Frobscottle? Oh, Alex knows.
Alex is going to help me cheat.
I'm going
to nobody pay any attention while Alex hisses the answer at me.
What's the answer? He's whispering.
We think it's a drink. We think it might
be a
drink.
It is a drink. It is a drink. I'll just pretend I didn't see that awful, horrendous cheating. So yeah, Frobscottle is a green-coloured fizzy drink where the bubbles go down instead of up. It features in the BFG. And speaking of the BFG...
BFG is my weak spot.
Oh no, I found your Achilles heel. Mark Rylance played the BFG in the 2016 film adaptation. And Lucy Dahl apparently really loved the film, so that's always nice to know. One final thing that I wanted to mention, which I thought was really lovely. You were talking about the kind of the words that he would use, the opposite words. Was this that what was in the school report?
Yeah. The exact opposite of what was intended.
Okay, so when his wife had had a stroke years ago, and part of Roald Dahl's own language that he made up was, it was called gobblefunk, which is a wonderful word. And he was inspired to create that and to create all these words like frobscottle and whipsy splunkers and all that sort of thing, because she had trouble with expressing herself after she had her stroke. So from something that stressful came something very, very wonderful. And there's a quote from him here. She struggled with her words like people do when they've had a stroke. She came up with all these funny words like obligon for a cigarette and you make me jake my diddles, meaning you're making me cross. So the next time somebody makes you cross, you can tell them that you make me jake my diddles. And if they don't know what you mean, then you don't need that kind of person in your life, really. If you'd like to win a copy of a surprise Roald Dahl book, a surprise because it's still on its way and I actually don't know what's going to land on my desk, please text in Roald Dahl to 4001 for a chance to win. It's really very easy. Don't forget to include your name either. So final thoughts on Roald Dahl. How much do we love him on a scale of 1 to 10?
Very much.
I would say
that's
12.
Not a number.
Yes, I'd go to 12.
Because I can't put a number on it. It's that much. Infinite.
Infinite.
To the moon and back.
Okay. So we've had Matilda, we've had George's Marvelous Medicine.
And yay, The Witches.
The Witches. And, I mean, David, what's your favourite? I never asked you.
Well, you know, I love reading about Roald Dahl's biography and how he was as a person. And I had a text in from one of the listeners, and I'm just reading it here, and it says, boy, wouldn't it be amazing to have had him as your father? Because you'd always never have to grow up.
Well, speaking of having him as your father, we actually have Lucy Dahl talking about how wonderful that was.
Gee, every single night, Dad used to sort of pace back and forth in my bedroom and tell us stories about the BFG that lived under our orchard. And then after he would tell us a story, we didn't know it was him, we thought it was the BFG. We used to have to leave our window open a tiny crack, and about 5 minutes later, a great big bamboo would come through the window, through our closed curtains, and my sister would get the first, and then I would get, and then it would retract. And so my whole childhood, I thought that the BFG was actually blowing dreams into our room.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. That was Lucy Dahl talking about how wonderful it was to have Roald Dahl as a father and all the wonderful things he used to do to keep the magic alive when they were little. I've had a text come in about an idea for a Wonka product that I need to share before we let you go. Multi-flavoured biro, each ink a different flavour. So an edible pen.
Nice. Alex had the similar idea earlier. He wanted an edible pencil, so when you're at school, you could eat and your teacher wouldn't know because it would grow back.
That's fantastic.
Brilliant.
So there we go. Edible pen, edible pencil. Thank you very much to our Roald Dahl festivity goers. That's
thank
not
you
even a
for
word.
Having us.
I hope you had a whipsy spunkers time. And we'll be seeing you for Woolly Mammoth Talk later, won't we, Rachel?
You certainly shall.
Stay tuned on Talking Books.
Young reviewer, young minds, big ideas. From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Good Morning and welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm the co-host today with Annabel Corton. My name is David McAdam, and we're going to swing into something new today, too. We're going to talk a little bit about book news, and let's get to that next.
Book news, your latest literary roundup.
So what's the book news today? What's hot in the book world?
Well, I've been interested lately in James Patterson, and I'm one of these people who hadn't really been made aware of James Patterson for many years, and I had a friend tell me that he's written about 147 novels, and he's been
147?
And he's been writing since 1976, and out of the 147 novels, 114 have hit the New York Best Times bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers list. So I started reading some of his books, and what I found by going to Borders Bookstore was that his books are like pay for one and get two thrown in. So I thought that was great. And so you can read them quickly, and they're thrillers. And then I got really interested in him because he has an online portal that you can go to, and he will give you instructions on how to write his type of book. So I've been so excited about watching, reading, and following on him. And then I found out just recently that in 2016, he made $96 million from his book sales. And over his career, he's made over $700 million. And he's a huge benefactor to so many different charities, and he's a great philanthropist. But he's also an amazing author, and he's prolific.
When you said that number, Rachel Hamilton, who we also have in the studio, looked a little deflated.
I haven't quite made that many millions writing books.
Have you written that many books yet?
No, I'll wait till I've written another 140 and then I'll be there.
You should start selling your unicorn formula.
I should indeed.
Louis the Unicorn, how to write the best unicorn book in the world. But that's something that's often levelled at him, though, that he writes to a formula and that it's very, very predictable.
He also has a team. Other people write for him, so that's why. I need a team. Well, Eddie, if you're out there listening and you want to be on my unicorn team, just let me know.
Sign me up. When I think of James Patterson, though, I mean, I do think, like you say, he often has a team of people. I think of a brand. I don't think of an author.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess that's the way you've got to do it if you want to make, what was it, $96 million?
In 2016.
In 1 year.
That's just insane. I'm really depressed now.
Also, I love the fact that he's being praised for being a philanthropist. What else are you going to do with all that money? You have to give some of it away.
Because he obviously doesn't spend money on anything else. I mean, if he was writing that many books, that's all he must do.
He can't ever go out.
He must never leave his house.
Well, he's frightfully introverted, it says in the words about him. And that he enjoys nothing more than sitting and dreaming up new plots.
Aww. That makes me like him. The other bit's slightly
less.
Well,
that's just a byproduct of, you know, when you think about an overnight success. I mean, in 1976 he started, and we're talking about 2016.
That's
good. So it's been a few years later, and he's the overnight success today.
Well, I've got some news as well, and it's somewhat old news if you think a couple of days ago is old news, but it does need to be mentioned on Talking of Books. And the shortlist for this year's more big money coming around now, £50,000 Booker Prize was announced this week. The list was culled from 13 to 6, and the finalists have been announced, I think, on the 13th of September. So we've got 4321 by Paul Auster, History of Wolves by Emily Friedland, Exit West by Mosin Hamid, Elmet by Fiona Mosley, Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, and Autumn by Ali Smith. Now, as usual, the shortlist has caused a lot of consternation and a lot of discussion and controversy, and everybody's arguing about it. And the winners will be announced on the 17th of October. And there will still be arguments after the winner has been announced.
Have you bought any of them yet?
I have.
I've ordered two.
You've ordered two? Which ones?
I ordered the Paul Auster and also, what was the Fiona Mosley?
Elmet?
Elmet, yes, yeah. That's it.
I'm really
ready to start next week.
I'm really put off the Paul Auster one, though, because it is a doorstop of a book.
Oh.
Isn't it huge?
It hasn't arrived yet.
Oh, it's huge. It's the biggest one, though. It's basically a doorstop. So if you don't like the book, you can use it to keep...
Hit children with.
That's not what I was going for, but anyways. So we have got to ask you a very important question, Rachel.
Go on.
Because you're here for the Castaway segment.
I am. You're shipwrecking me.
I am. Stranding you on a desert
you're
island.
Shipwrecking an underdeveloped adult on a desert island.
Yeah.
I hear the waves.
Yeah, the crashing of the waves. In other news, before we move on to that, it seems fitting to mention that survival expert and TV personality Bear Grylls' new book will be out soon, and it's called How to Stay Alive.
That's what I should be taking to the desert.
You lucked out. You should have taken that with you. So it's a compendium of lessons he's learned on his adventures, paragliding over Everest and doing all that sort of crazy stuff. And it's out on the 2nd of November. And it's not going to help you now because first book you've chosen?
Too late. Well, see, the honest answer to this desert island question, and I've always thought this, is I would take ones I haven't read yet, but that would make for quite a boring segment of the radio because I'd have nothing to say. But wouldn't you? If you were going to a desert island, you'd take something you hadn't read.
So you were just going to read off a list of titles?
Like, I don't know, long books I haven't read, Middlemarch.
Middlemarch is fantastic.
But no, in reality, I have chosen as my first book, Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman. And it was a big sort of fight in my head as to, it had to be a book by Neil Gaiman or Terry Pratchett or Douglas Adams, because they've been formative, they've kept me happy for decades. And it was picking which one of those. And Neverwhere, I think I picked... Oh, I can still hear the waves. I like it. Neverwhere I chose because it was one of the first to make an impression on me. And it's the first real book that Neil Gaiman wrote. And he's been a bit of an inspiration. I know he's now become so mammoth. He's a bit like James Patterson. And, he's not even, doesn't even feel human anymore. Mm. But the books are great. And I love Neverwhere because it feels quite early. So you can see how his style has changed over the years. And actually something like American Gods or even Coraline, they follow the same sort of pattern, which is this idea of a kind of every person being sucked into a magical, dangerous world and sort of finding their way through it, not always brilliantly. And I think because Neverwhere was the first one, that's the one I've picked. Shall I read the blurb? So if anyone hasn't read it, they know roughly what it'll be about. Okay, so under the streets of London lies a world most people could never dream of. When Richard Mayhew helps a mysterious girl he finds bleeding on the pavement, his boring life changes in an instant. Her name is Dor, she's on the run from two assassins in black suits, and she comes from London below. Richard's act of kindness leads him to a place filled with monsters and angels, a beast in a labyrinth, and an earl who holds court in a tube station. It's strangely familiar, yet utterly bizarre. Okay, I don't know if that sounds exciting to everyone, but I love that idea.
This is literally a tale of two cities, though, isn't it?
Yes. It's almost like...
Two Londons, rather.
Yes. And it's a bit like... Is it the city that was written? I've just had one of those brain blanks and I've forgotten who wrote it. Fantastic.
I can't
science
help,
fiction.
I can't
it will
remember.
Come to me later and then I shall remember who wrote it. But yeah, it's brilliant. And it started life... This is what's so interesting about it. It didn't start life as a book.
No, it
didn't. It started
didn't.
Life as a television series. And even before that, it sort of started life as a conversation between Neil Gaiman and Lenny Henry, who... Anyone who's listening who's British and probably around 30, 40 will remember Lenny Henry. I'm not sure if he's on TV much anymore, but he was a huge comedian back at the time Neverwhere was written in the kind of 90s. And he said to Neil Gaiman he wanted to write a story about homeless people and about London's homeless. And Neil Gaiman has said in interviews that he was nervous about that because what he didn't want to do was kind of make Sleeping Rough seem like a cool thing to do. So instead, he said that he started to think about writing a story about people who've slipped through the cracks in society. So maybe the homeless, maybe other people. And this idea that below the real London that people see with the businessmen and, you know, the typical everyday life going ahead, there was this other London underneath, a more kind of mystical, foggy place where people could get forgotten. Mm. And it's really interesting. And it works, I think, both as that sort of exploration, but also as a great story.
So the main character is businessman Richard Mayhew.
Yeah, and he's leading a pretty boring, ordinary life. He works in a boring, ordinary office. There's a fantastic radio version with James McAvoy, who's played that kind of character before. And he is the perfect kind of idea in your head of someone who's just sort of getting through. Richard's come from Scotland to London thinking that there's going to be big opportunities for him, but actually job is boring, everything is boring. He's got this girlfriend who is so upwardly mobile, pressuring him all the time to be perfect, to dress perfectly. And that when the big event comes, when he meets Dor, who sucks him down into London below, he's going with this girlfriend Jessica to meet her boss, on whom he has to make this great impression. And instead of going to this wonderful restaurant, he stops to help this girl who's appeared out of nowhere bleeding and in tatters. And that's kind of how it begins. And you see him move from one kind of life, the typical everyday life, into another. And so that he takes the girl home, looks after her, she recovers, sends him to go and find this Marquis de Carabas to rescue her. This man appears, and then they both disappear in the broom cupboard, and he doesn't know where they've gone. And then he thinks life will go back to normal, but it's one of those things where life will never be the same again.
So who would you recommend this to?
I think Neil Gaiman said that he wanted to write a book, for underdeveloped adults, a book for adults who wanted to read the same kind of thing they'd read as children, like Alice in Wonderland or The Wizard of Oz, or, you know, have some sort of magic in their lives. But it is adult. The language is adult. I mean, older teenagers could read it. But yeah, I think people like me, if it's for underdeveloped adults.
I think Neil Gaiman's quite wonderful, not only in his writing, but in the advice that he gives to aspiring writers and encouraging other creative people. So here's him giving some advice to an aspiring writer, if you are one out there listening.
What is your number one tip for an aspiring writer?
Finish things.
Yeah, get to work.
You know, that's got to be, I mean, write is only takes you so far. Finish things takes you most of the rest of the way. Write things people want to read. Write things you care about. I get puzzled and lost when people start asking me questions about what they should be writing for the market or whatever. There is no market. There's nobody in the whole world of marketing ever would have woken up one day and said, a series of unfortunate events is exactly what the world needs.
Yeah.
You know, nobody would have turned around and gone, your market niche is do a sort of reply to Kipling's The Jungle Book and set it in the graveyard. That's not, you know, things like that happen because somebody wants to tell a story and because you have an idea and because you think you can tell that story better than anybody else.
And it turns out there's room, which is, I think, so inspiring to me. I mean, when I was starting out, I felt like there wasn't room. I think it's something that our characters feel in books that we do, that they feel shut out. Coraline thinks, what am I doing here? Gwen thinks, I want to leave the world and be a pirate. And I think that it speaks to some alienation that you feel when you're starting out as a writer. You think there is literature, and there's the stupid scribbles that I'm doing, and there's no room for it. And it turns out there is. It turns out that the world of literature is infinite and wide, and I'm forever grateful to be part of the adventure where people come to a dark room and talk about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books, here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello, welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corton. With me in the studio, my co-host David McAdam. And we are grilling our guest reviewer today for Castaway, Rachel Hamilton, who's been given only 3 books to take with her to a desert island rather than anything actually useful.
Books are useful.
Yeah, to pass the time. But Bear Grylls might have been a bit more useful.
Might have been
for
a
the
more
survival
sensible
side
thing
of
to
things.
Take, yes.
Yeah. So your second book, what have you got for your second book today?
My second book is probably my favourite book ever, and it's The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, Age 13 and 3/4, by Sue Townsend. And I absolutely love this book. It's been almost like my therapy over the years. Mm. Whenever I feel sad, this is the book I pick up because it never fails to make me laugh. And it's one of those books that has evolved over time. Because I read it first at 9 years old, and obviously huge amounts of it whooshed over my head. Absolutely, yeah. I had no idea, you know, what any of it meant. Mr. Lucas and Adrian's mum didn't have a clue what was going on there, just like Adrian didn't. And I think when you reread it as an adult, it's obviously written for adults because so much of the humour becomes accessible when you understand. But even as a child, I mean, the first time I read it, I actually thought that some of Adrian Mole's poetry was good. So it's grown up with me almost, and I just think it's the perfect book.
To provide a little bit of context, if you've never read The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, Age 13 and 3/4, it's comedic fiction, obviously written in the style of a diary, about the worries and regrets of a teenager who really thinks that he is an intellectual and above everybody else, doesn't he?
He does. But it's done really warmly. I think it could have been done in a comic way that made him a sort of an awful, pitiful... Well, he is quite a pitiful character, but you love him at the same time as mocking him hugely. It's beautiful.
If you'd like to hear a little bit of the style of the book, here are three short extracts from the book read by some wonderful actors.
Saturday, January the 24th. Today was the most terrible day of my life. Pandora is going out with Nigel.
I think I will never get over the shock.
Sunday, January the 25th, 10 a.m. I am ill with all the worry, too weak to write much. Nobody has noticed I haven't eaten any breakfast.
2 p.m. Had two junior aspirins at midday and rallied a bit. Perhaps when I'm famous and my diary is discovered, people will understand the torment of being a 13 3/4-year-old undiscovered intellectual.
It's brilliant. I love it. But also, I love the way it's written without too much sort of pomp and ceremony. It's just a fun... There's one extract, I forget what date it is, but it's just went to see Rob Roy's grave, saw it, came back. I just think it's brilliant. It's funny without trying too hard. And she perfectly puts kind of sentences together, picks the right words. It's brilliant. Love it.
What I also love is the fact that, I mean, this is set in 1981 and 1982. So in some ways, I mean, some people have said, we've got Catelyn Moran talking about this as well in a little while, how it encapsulated kind of growing up in the 80s.
Oh, absolutely. This was my era, if that makes sense. So it's almost like a little time capsule for me. It's in not only the 80s, it also carries on. So it goes through the Gulf War, it goes through weapons of mass destruction, it goes through Tony Blair, and it just... It's a perfect, almost like a historical document in many ways, and it's so well done.
And an amusing one.
Very fun. And what's particularly funny is that you watch Adrian Mole kind of get everything wrong. So he assumes that the Hitler diaries were genuine, and obviously you're reading after the fact. Or he talks as if the Iraqis are going to win the war. You know, it's just, it's so cleverly done that... I just think she's brilliant. She's my hero, Sue Townsend.
So I think Catelyn Moran agrees with you, but here's her in a programme about Adrian Mole and Sue Townsend, and I really want to hear your opinion on what she's got to say.
One of the things that annoys me is that people will talk about sort of the classic British novels of the 1980s and people will go, it was Martin Amis, you know, it was money, that was what summed up sort of Britain, that's the classic British novel. But I think the classic British novel of the 1980s was written by a single mum from the Midlands who didn't go to university. It is Adrian Mole. That is everything that you need to know about Britain at that time.
Couldn't agree more. And also, to be fair, she was the top seller as far as I know in the 80s, and I think about, is it 10 million books have sold, so she hasn't done too badly. Yeah. And whenever anybody talks about how it's male authors that do well, you just have to Sue Townsend and J.K. Rowling, two of the best-selling British authors ever. Women, yay.
Is this something that you've read, David?
Oh, you have to. I'll lend you my copy. It's
please, that'd
just
be wonderful.
The funniest thing ever. It's brilliant. It really is.
So we've had Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman and The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, age 13 3/4, by Sue Townsend. And that's absolutely fantastic. I'm so glad that you've chosen some funny stuff to take with you to your desert island. But why are you taking these to a desert island? I mean, you're going to be stuck there for a very long time.
Well, I'm one of these people that is either up or down. So either life is absolutely brilliant and I'm an Oompa Loompa and everything's fantastic, or I can get a bit depressed. And the way I pick myself up is through books. And I thought, if I took The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, then I'll never be miserable on my desert island. And that was the kind of thinking behind it. And also with Neverwhere, it was reminding myself that there's much more to where you are and there are things below the surface. So I think it was more a psychological choice rather than trying to fill my time. And also, I do tend to spend all my time reading. So I thought if I take slightly shorter books, I might explore the island and do some fishing and that kind of thing.
And actually survive.
And actually live, yes. Until well Bear Grylls turns up.
Until Bear Grylls turns up and rescues
waiting.
You.
Yeah.
So Rachel can't escape the island until she's told us about book 3. So don't leave her stranded. We're getting some great texts in to keep them coming on 4001.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.